everybody. I'm Michelle, an alcoholic.
Hi, Michelle.
My sobriety date is June 28th, 2008. My sponsor is Ivy. Some of you might know her. My home group is the Camel Group in Arlington on Monday nights. If you're ever down that way, come and see us. It's a great meeting. All right, so this is not my favorite thing to do. I'm just going to put that out there. However, Alcoholics Anonymous truly saved my life. So when I am asked to do something, even if it's not my favorite thing, I do it. Because this is my primary purpose, to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And in doing that, I get to stay sober myself and live another sober day. So there's that. Got butterflies going on, guys. Anyways, so I'm going to start. I like that reading that that you read. I have actually never heard that, so that's really awesome. There's always something new in the book. Every time I open it, I find something new. Even though, like, I've got so many notes in this one. This is mine. I've had it for a good number of years and got it underlined and highlighted, and different things pop out at different times. But I'm going to start with reading a passage from A Vision for You, just to kind of like get me centered. And if you guys don't get anything from what I say, at least you're getting something from the book. So there's that. You know what I mean? All right. So this is A Vision for You from chapter 11. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did, then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. We have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum, like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. And these are promises here. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find fellowship, and so will you. So, I think that's my favorite part of the big book. When I first read that, the shivering denizen of King Alcohol, I was like, yes, I really get that. Because I was a knockdown, drag-out drunk, and at the end, I was a drunken, junkie stripper, and I couldn't get enough in me to make the madness go away and quiet the committee in my head. And so, anyways, I'll get to my story now. I guess, first of all, the day that Billy called me was the end of August. It was the last Sunday of August, and my mother passed away that day. And so, you know, I got really sad. It was, my life got turned upside down. In a different way, that my life got turned upside down when I got sober. My primary purpose is still here, and you know, there was God giving me another task to do for Alcoholics Anonymous to keep me going, and so I said yes, and so here I am. And thank you all for having me. I you know, people were not asking me around, let alone to say anything, because everything that came out of my mouth when I was drinking was bullshit. Excuse me. I guess I didn't ask about that, but because sometimes I have a dirty mouth. Sorry in advance. Anyways. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be there while my mother was on hospice, and I got to be there for my dad and my brother. I received cancer drugs from hospice delivery that were like Dilaudid, like really heavy painkillers, like liquid that I could just, you know, because I did a lot of drugs too. But, you know, because of a loving higher power, I put it in the refrigerator because it said refrigerate upon arrival, and I walked away from it, and I didn't have an obsession about it. And that is God. Because, man, I put anything in me that would make me feel different before. There's that. So if I get kind of choked up and teary, that's I got stuff going on, and it's kind of weird, but it's getting better. I just keep putting one foot in front of the other and praying a lot. So I grew up in Maryland, and my mom always said that I was a really good kid. I was good in school. I was good with friends. I think I had, though, it seemed like, what I remember, I had one friend at a time, and I was like really kind of clingy and needy with them. Now looking back on that, at the time I didn't see it like that, and then they would get sick of me, and they wouldn't want to be my friend anymore, and I was left alone again and unsure, like, okay, what's happening here? But I had a younger brother. He was 7 years younger than me, and I felt very jealous of him because it seemed like my parents put all of their focus and attention on him. But he was kind of a troublemaker. I remember babysitting him, and he was like probably seven or something. He started a fire in the basement because he was playing with matches by the trash can by the dryer, so there was lint. And he started a fire, and I was babysitting him. And, you know, he got in trouble, and it turned out he had ADD, and he was given medication, and then he was fixed. He's a completely normal, well-adjusted human being, and my parents are like, we don't know who raised him. My dad is alcoholic. He's sober now as well, and my mom was Al-Anon. But I was just really jealous of him, my brother, for a long time. Anyways, fast forward to my drinking. I don't know what kind of drew me to those bad kids that we kind of gravitate towards. It just looked like fun to me. It looked exciting. And this one girl I went home with after school, and we just decided to go in her mom's liquor cabinet, and it was her first time drinking too. We took a little bit of everything out of her mom's liquor cabinet and put it in a blender, and I knew it wouldn't taste very good, so I put some ice cream in it. And I will tell you, like, I remember all the details. I remember it like it was yesterday. We, like, made all these, like, drunk phone calls. We were laughing. I didn't realize how uncomfortable I had felt until I got drunk like that, and I felt just completely at ease with everyone and everything around me, and nothing mattered. And it was love. It was like the greatest love affair that eventually turned on me badly. But So immediately I fell in love with it, and I sought it out as much as I could. I was 13, so it was kind of hard to get. And drugs are a big part of my story, so I am going to talk about those, so sorry. I know this is an AA meeting. Trust me, I drank right there along with it. It was like they went together like peanut butter and jelly. And so, I mean, the more the better. You keep it coming, whatever it was, it didn't matter. I had my favorites. And I wasn't afraid to use needles. So I, like I said, I was a junkie, and I shot up whatever I could shoot up. I even, I'll go off on a tangent here, but I lived in Hawaii for a while, and I was trying to detox myself from heroin. So I couldn't keep anything down. Like, I was trying to drink, but I couldn't keep anything down, so I decided to shoot up the alcohol. And, whoo, that burned like a son of a bitch, but I did it again anyways, because it didn't matter, you know, like, didn't matter how it tasted, and didn't matter, I just wanted the madness to stop, you know. I have this beast inside me that is alcoholism, and it's still there even today, you know, so, I keep coming to do this. So I'm going to be all over the place. I'm sorry. I haven't done this in a while. And like I said, life is kind of weird right now. Okay. I'll go on some, like, I don't know if you want to call them high points or whatever, but pivoting points, I guess. When I was 17, I was put into this outpatient rehab and therapy and stuff like that. You know, my parents wanted to fix me. They thought, my mom said, was a nurse, and so she wanted to go the medical route, so I was in outpatient rehab. But I met this girl who did a lot of drugs, and I was, just became friends with her. And so I started doing a lot of drugs, too. And she hooked me up with this guy who was a little bit older, and he wanted to have me try and sell drugs to my classmates. And I was home one night trying to set up packages for school the next day, and everybody was supposed to be gone. But then in came my dad, surprise, and I got caught. We were both kind of in shock. So he took my purse to the police station and left me there. And I just went, I hid up a tree for a couple hours. And anyways, next day I got consequences, which were possession with intent to distribute, because it was quite a bit. And I was 17, so I was lucky in that sense. I basically got a slap on the wrist. I went to my first inpatient rehab. I cried a lot. I learned how to lie better. I got more sneaky. I knew that I wasn't done, but these consequences kind of sucked. I had to go to meetings, so this was like my first dabble into AA, but you know, I wasn't in the meeting. I was outside smoking cigarettes and talking to boys, getting boyfriends, going to AA dances, but not, I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't do any steps. I was not interested. I wasn't ready. The day that I got off of probation, I packed stuff in probably a trash bag or something and I left. I was 18. I went with that guy in who had me sell the drugs. I moved in with him in this apartment in Georgetown, and it was like fun again. I didn't have anything on my back. My parents weren't there. I was still in school at that time, but he was older, so we had the hookup in bars. I was 18, and I was like underage drinking in all these like bars and nightclubs, and it was awesome. Like, I had arrived. It talked about in the big book, like, this is it. This is awesome. This is exciting. Yeah. But, you know, as soon as somebody would say, this guy said to me that he didn't want me to do any hard drugs. It was okay to do this drug, but not to do that drug. But I really wanted to do that drug. So I was like, okay, we're done. See you later. I'm going to go and do that and have fun, and you can, I'm done with you. I'm, you know, I, I wrung them out and threw them out. That's what I did. I was a user of people and a taker of things. And it didn't matter how you felt or what you said. I was going to do what I was going to do. My mind was made up, and you couldn't change it. And so I kind of moved from guy to guy. I wasn't, like, technically homeless, per se, because I would just move in with somebody. You know what I mean? She knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. But some people have classified that as homeless. So, however, I did have a roof over my head. Who knows how I got like that, but it wasn't the most ladylike, I'll tell you that. So, fast forward, I went to San Diego with the boyfriend who was supposed to be my soulmate. And this guy was like a really, really bad alcoholic. He would empty a box of wine into a 2-liter bottle and just turn it upside down and finish it. And then start throwing things. So this guy made my drinking look like a tea party. And I ended up sleeping with his best friend. And then I was done with him. I was done with both of them, and I moved on to somebody else. You know, like, I started doing these things that I would have never done. My parents didn't teach me that way. You know, I grew up Catholic. I had good grades in school. But alcohol really changed me. Alcohol and drugs really changed me. It was totally Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And, you know, from San Diego, I went to Hawaii. And I went to these beautiful places. But you know what? I was rarely, if I was on the beach in the daytime, I was like probably blacked out. You know what I mean? Yeah, or hungover or something. 'Cause I remember coming home for a family reunion in the summer at like Outer Banks. And my grandmother looked at me and she's like, "You live in Hawaii and you're paler than the rest of us. What's up with you?" You know? And I didn't have anything to tell her. I was just like, "I don't know." When I was in Hawaii, I got this boyfriend, different guy than who I moved out there with. He was in the Navy, and I don't know. He was just there. When I was kicked out of the previous place that I was kicked out of, he was there, and he had money, and he had drugs, and he had plenty of alcohol. And that's all I wanted, you know? Like, that's literally all I wanted. And he was a drug dealer, actually. He had a safe under the bed. And whenever he was in the shower or at work, I would go and sneak in and take my cash. It wasn't my cash, actually. I shouldn't say that. It was his. But I would take whatever I wanted. And he was none the wiser until I got to this place where it could have been a bottom, but then it wasn't. You know, I kept going. You know, I found a bottom, and then there was a trap door, and I fell even deeper. I remember, like, drinking against my will, you know, and specifically shooting up against my will. I didn't want to do it, but I didn't want to feel the way that I was feeling, so I did it anyways. And I was just crying, and then I would take a shot, and I would feel okay for a couple of minutes, and I would start crying again. It was like, I really don't want to be doing this, but I don't know any other way. I had no power of choice there. The choice was gone. It was purely habit. And like I said, it wasn't quieting the beast within anymore. So he paid for me to go to culinary school, and that was fun. I finally found something that I felt good about. I love cooking. I love food. Sure, why not? He paid for it, so why not? I remember halfway through this one semester, I was cooking at home for friends, and I was like, drinking a little, you know, like, what was that one old lady chef who passed away? But a little for me, a little for the sauce, a little for me, a little more for me, a little for the sauce. So that's what I was doing, and I didn't feel like I was drunk. Like, I was maintaining at this point. If you would have been talking to me, I probably didn't sound drunk or slurred or anything. But what I did was I set my hand on the burner all the way to see if it was hot. And it was. So I got a huge spiral burn on my palm, and I couldn't finish the semester. And I couldn't finish the dinner that night. It was so painful. I was like, I couldn't drink enough to make the pain go away. I had to go to the hospital and everything. But I got painkillers, so that was fun. Anyways, I cried and cried when I had to go and talk to, the chef, instructor. He was so nice. I don't know how I got away with this, but I literally got away with this. They let me retake the class for free, like the whole semester. I didn't have to pay for it. And I don't know how the hell I swung that, but I did. He liked me or something. I don't know. But apparently, whatever. So I got through that, and anyways, I acquired a skill. So there was some positivity out of being in Hawaii other than track marks and yellowish skin from drinking all day and all night. But anyways, this guy was pretty abusive, and so was I. You know, he would forcefully try and keep me from going out and getting hard drugs and just try and give me more alcohol. But, like, I loved alcohol, but that just wasn't enough for me at that time. So we would get into huge fights, and I would just take off. So, anyways, he got me on methadone. I started methadone when I was in Hawaii, and that didn't stop me. I drank every day on top of it. I did more drugs on top of it. It was a crutch, you know. I didn't get sick when I didn't have anything, but if you ever go that route, just go to detox and get it over with. It was really painful to get off of. So, anyways, I got to this place, the jumping off place, when I was there, and I called my parents, and I just couldn't imagine my life going the way it was. I couldn't imagine drinking as much as I had been, and I didn't know how to stop. So my parents rescued me. They paid for me to come home, and it was like right after 9/11. And I was very underweight. I had this yellowish, grayish skin color, and I was crazy. So also, let me back up. Every time I moved someplace, I always said, okay, I'm going to stop doing the hard drugs, but I'm going to drink. Drinking is legal, because by this time I was 21. Drinking is legal. I can handle it. It's fine. Everybody does it. But then I kept doing the same things, expecting different results. And I could never stop at just drinking. So I got back home, and that's what I said to myself. I'm just going to drink. It's Jack Daniels. I'm not going to drink that. That I end up into face plants in the pavement, or kicking my boyfriend's car in, or, you know, it's Jack Daniel's fault. I can still drink Crown Royal and be fine. So that is what I did, and, you know, I got to the same place. I got this really good job, though. I started a job at Ritz-Carlton, and I was like, okay, this is awesome. I really like this, and we had this arrangement with the bartender or the servers. They would bring us back a really nice bottle of wine or even hard liquor, whatever we wanted, as long as we would, like, cook for them. It was cool. It was a cool deal. So we had that going. And then when we closed the restaurant, we would all go to a bar downtown, and it was fun. And I thought that I could manage this thing again, you know. I wasn't doing the hard drugs. I was starting to again. There we go again. But it was mostly drinking at this point, and it was fun. And I thought I had a handle on everything. We do. And And eventually, I don't know what happened, but I started shooting dope again. And I don't know how I got there. How did I get here again? Keep doing the same things, you're going to get the same results. And I just had to keep pounding my head in the pavement. I really did. So fast forward. Eventually, Ritz-Carlton couldn't pay for my habit anymore. And my performance on the job was pretty poor. I started to get really slow, and I would, like, cut myself a lot or burn myself. Some kind of kitchen accident. I would, like, trip over things, and, like, I was very accident prone. And I remember he was like security or loss prevention or whatever there at the Ritz when I was working there. And he was sober at the time, and he enabled me. But every time I got into these accidents, you know, you had to sign a waiver if you're going to give a drug test or not. And somehow he was like, if we give a drug test, are you going to pop positive? And I was like, yeah. He was like, okay, so he somehow, like, got under the, I don't know. But when I saw him, when I finally got sober, I was like, oh, my God, I remember you. Anyways, so I quit there, and I started stripping, you know, a stripper job. I mean, stripper drinks are, like, at the time, they were, like $15 or something, and I would get part of that, and the bar would get part of that, you know, and then you'd also get tons of tips. So I was like, perfect, I can drink on the job and it's okay. They encourage it, you know, they pay you to get drinks, you know what I mean? And so that's what I did. And I wasn't a very good stripper, actually. I wasn't the nicest, you know. Yeah, I hated when people tried to touch me or something, and I would just flip out. I would lash out. I would, like, throw my shoes at them, and they were, like, those big 8-inch heels. They're really heavy, and anyways, I got fired from a bunch of stripper jobs, and it's pretty bad to get fired from that, you know. Yeah, so one night I was driving home, like, a bat out of hell because I was angry that somebody touched me, and I got pulled over. And so this is the beginning of the really what happened part. I got pulled over, and a guy, I had been drinking, but he didn't give me a sobriety test, but he did find some paraphernalia in my car. And so then I had to start going back to outpatient and get drug tests twice a week. And it was terrible. But I just drank. And I was on methadone at the time also. I drank on top of methadone, and that's pretty dangerous, actually. A lot of people die from that, mixing those two things. And so, yeah, God definitely has a purpose for me. I started going to those things, but I just couldn't, I mean, outpatient classes and stuff like that, but I couldn't pass a drug test to save my life. I even paid for those detox drinks that they used to sell. I don't know if they still sell them, but anyways, they didn't work. So I had to go to rehab again. I went to Avery Road, which is in Rockville, Maryland, and I went there about 3 times, and I got kicked out twice. I'll skip forward to the last part. The last time I was there, I got kicked out, like, maybe the second day that I was there, because I went into the employee area to get my chocolate that I tried to smuggle in. It's just chocolate. It was so dumb. So I got kicked out, and I had to go to another hospital to get back in. And I was on methadone for a long time, so it was a long detox. I couldn't just stop doing it. I had to be medicated. I don't know. Anyways, how did I get here again? I keep getting kicked out of places. Nobody wants me around. The boyfriend that I had pretty much hated me at this point. I wasn't speaking to my family. I didn't really have any friends. When we would get together, I would just drink and not really have much laughter to give. It had become not fun anymore. It was just my habit that I was trying to maintain. And it wasn't working anymore. And so I had to go to long-term Avery Road, and I got kicked out of there because, you know, I cooked, right? So I didn't know any other way to cook except with alcohol. So I got kicked out of rehab for cooking with alcohol in rehab. And I knew it was wrong because I was hiding it, but I still was angry when I did get kicked out. You know, it was, anyways. So what saved me was when I was there, I got a sponsor, and she was part of the Midtown group, and that was my first home group, and it was extremely enthusiastic, and I was pretty belligerent, to say the least. I didn't want the stupid, boring, and glum AA life that I thought was going to happen, right? I guess I had my first step there. I knew I couldn't do it without help. You know, I went into rehab. I got off the hard stuff. And then my second step was, I remember when I was in this long term, my dad had called and told me that he got in a car accident and he totaled his truck. And I had thought he had been sober this whole time, but he was drinking in secret, and that's why he got into this terrible car wreck, and he walked away without a scratch, and he just, like, hit a tree or a pole or something. And he told me that he knew where he needed to go, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's been there ever since, and this was about 10 years ago. And so I was like, shit, that means I have to go to AA too. I had tried the other fellowship, NA, but because I thought, you know, drugs are cool, right? Alcohol is boring. That's what I thought for a long time. This is what kept me away from Alcoholics Anonymous for so long, was that, you know, my drugs were so, like, glaring in my story that, you know, I kind of forgot about all the blackouts, all the things that I did when I was drinking, for drinking. I forgot about all of that stuff. Needless to say, I was driving around with the Gatorade bottle full of, this is just water, by the way. But I would drive and drink all the time. I couldn't go to the grocery store without my Gatorade bottle of vodka and ginger ale. I had tequila in the freezer at all times. You know, I just kind of pushed that stuff away. I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my dad. But when he told me that, I was like, okay, I guess I'll try this thing. And so, you know, I allowed people to start helping me. I allowed them to pick me up and take me to meetings and call me. Ugh. I remember I didn't have a cell phone when I got sober. I didn't have anything. I had a couple of garbage bags full of things that I somehow acquired. Like, I got so bloated from drinking once I started getting those drug tests of drinking every day that, like, all my clothes didn't fit. The shirts came up here, so it was, like, not cute belly shirts, and my jeans were too tight. Like, I was not cute at all. And I just had this alcohol bloat. I look back at these pictures from years ago, and, like, my face was even, like, swollen from alcohol bloat. I was like, okay, I guess I'm alcoholic too. And so I remember kind of having this, God's grace came in, and, you know, that's all I can say. I can't explain it in any other way, but in 2007, I guess, I finally had some willingness to do what you guys were doing, and I finally started listening to what you were saying and taking suggestions that you were giving me, like my life depended on it. You know, my first sponsor told me that, I mean, these are only suggestions, but you don't think you're dying? You know what I mean? I really was. I wanted to die every day, but I just kept coming to. I just kept coming to. And, you know, I remember waking up in places with strange men. I didn't know where I was. I would have to, like, search the place for a piece of mail that was, like, that had the address on it so I could call some friends to come and pick me up. Like, that's the kind of stuff that was happening on the regular. And it wasn't, I was like, okay, I think I'm done. at some, you know, I think I'm done with this now. And my sponsor put me to work. I started greeting at meetings, and I hated greeting. I hated it so much. I just wanted to be, like, somewhere else still, you know. But I did it. Anyways, she told me, F your feelings and get in the car and go to the meeting and be of service and get a job. Once I got out of rehab, I had to get a job. And actually, this guy who was in AA, he worked at the Whole Foods Market in Fairfax, and he got me the job. And so I got a job really quickly in sobriety. And my sponsor was like, treat it like a service position. Show up on time and do the work when you're there and leave on time and arrange, because I didn't have a car, I didn't have a cell phone, arrange rides to get you from work to the meeting. So those were directions that I was following, and it worked pretty much. I got into a sober house when I had about 3 months, and this woman helped me so much. And unfortunately, she is no longer sober. She was my best friend when I, you know, first came around in the Midtown group. And actually, I came here with her, and I believe she spoke here. I've kind of made Marissa. But anyways, she would have a couple years sober and then drink again and then get sober again. And then, you know, so she's just back and forth. But she is not sober now. And that is, like, I would, like, try and help her, pick her up and take her to meetings. And she would just reek of alcohol and get in my car and smell like that. And then I'm like, do you think I'm stupid? And I would kind of take it personally, you know. And my sponsor was like, that's not, that's just the beast. Like, you can't compete with that. She's not going to be ready until she's ready, if she's ready. But I would get really angry about that at first, and I had to do a lot of praying about it. But it's really sad, you know. It's really sad because she helped me out so much when I was new. It was my first sober house, you know. I learned how to be sober and go to work and go to meetings and go to events and all this stuff with her. And, you know, she started doing, you know, what we do, keeping secrets, getting resentments, and then that's what happens, you know. So I have to stay on top of that myself. So anyways, my fourth step, the first time I did wrong, I don't even know how I did wrong, but I couldn't see my part, you know, for a lot of it. So I had to rewrite it. You know, I feel like I got the most relief from it, like, with my current sponsor. Because she kind of, at the end of it, we looked up the list of character defects. You can just Google it, character defects of 12-step work, and it's online. And I pretty much connected to every single defective character that was on there. I was like, ugh, what do I do with all this? So then I start praying, you know. I say the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer every day, usually at night. I'm not good at doing the stuff in the morning. I'm just not. I need to just get coffee and maybe say a prayer on the way. But, yeah, definitely at night I do this stuff. But, and then any additional prayers that pop up. But I guess my first eighth step that I wrote was very kind of robotic. I had no emotional attachment to it. It was bigger than my fourth step, that's for sure. But I still didn't like have an emotional connection to it. You know, I didn't see how I really was and how I caused this kind of damage in other people's lives and how much of a tornado that I was in everybody's life around me, whoever I touched, you know. And again, it wasn't until my current sponsor, the last, I don't know how long she's been sponsoring me now, Ivy, at least like 4 or 5 years, but she has helped me, you know, the most. My first sponsor also, I don't think she's drinking, but she's not in AA anymore. And I will tell you why I switched sponsors from her to Ivy. So I have this other clinical condition that Alcoholics Anonymous cannot treat. And she had a very strong opinion on that based on her sponsor, based on her sponsor, based on so on. And unfortunately, it's my path. You know, I took their advice, and it was wrong. And so I had a resentment, but I don't hate her for it today, you know. I certainly blamed her for it. So I have anxiety, depression, and really bad insomnia, point blank, for which I need to seek medical care, and I take medication for under doctor's orders. My sponsor is aware of it, and so is my doctor. And so we're cool, my current sponsor. My first sponsor was not okay with that. She didn't see that as being sober. So there's that. I had to come to this place where it was okay. You know, I ended up in the psych ward in sobriety because I was under direction from that sponsor to live like this. You know, like I was had a baby. I had really bad postpartum, and what it came down to was I wasn't sleeping, and I couldn't get this thought of like I'm going to smother him with a pillow, and then I'm going to go get some heroin or something and overdose myself. I'm going to kill both of us. And that's not sober living. We don't get sober to live like that. You know what I mean? So I had to go into the psych ward to get rearranged in my head. And now it's okay. You know, I had to get rid of those old ideas. And medication for me is okay. It's all right. So sorry I had to say that, but that's just my experience. Yes, it is an outside issue, but it's because it is okay with my sponsor today and myself and my higher power that I'm still sober today and I'm not self-medicating with alcohol or hard drugs, you know what I mean? So there's that. My ninth step, I have made a lot of living amends, mostly to my, you know, family. I got pregnant very soon into sobriety. Thank God it was by a very solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, he's a really good dude. He is not somebody who I would have been after out there when he's, like, so normal and, like, well-adjusted. He's an alcoholic, yes. So he's crazy like I am a little bit. But I feel totally taken care of with him. I got pregnant very soon in sobriety. I changed my sobriety date. Because of the self-medicating stuff. And anyways, that was 2008. I got pregnant pretty much immediately after. And then, I couldn't make these, like, financial amends. This baby just takes all my money. He is 7 now. And I'm a pretty good mom to him. I don't feel like that every day. But he has told me, I want to spend time with you, Mom. And I'm like, really? Because I still have that in my head, like, nobody likes me. I don't know what you're thinking about me. You looked at me weird, so I don't think you like me. I'm a terrible mom. Like, I have this still negative stuff in my head that I need a higher power to, and my sponsor, and my AA friends to be like, you know what, stop it, you're fine. Anyways, I made amends to my dad and my mom and my grandparents. And a couple, like, the last amends that I made was actually right before my mom started hospice. And this one was pretty good. I don't know if you want to call it good or whatever, but it really got home to me. This is to my best friend when I was drinking. He and I were like this. We were like ride or die, you know what I mean? But I was a tornado in his life. I destroyed his property. I was not a good friend. And his wife posted on Facebook that he's got cirrhosis of the liver. He definitely needs a liver transplant. He's 37 years old, and if he doesn't get this transplant, he's going to die, and he definitely cannot drink again. And I was like, wow. Okay, so I guess it's time to make that amends to him. And so I did. I wrote stuff down, and I read it over with my sponsor. And she was like, don't read it. Just be open. So that's how it was. I went to go see him, and I didn't go by myself. I took another friend with me because, you know, we have safety in numbers. You know, if you have to make amends to somebody who you used to drink with, it's pretty smart to take somebody with you if you can. So I did, and man, he looks terrible. He looks terrible. But we sat on this park bench for like 2 hours or something and just talked. And in his mind, I was still a nice girl because he told me about these other girls who like chased him with like knives and like all this crazy stuff. I was like, okay, well, this is so that I can still stay sober. Like, this is what I have to do to stay sober myself. And he was like, okay. And I gave him a little bit of money. And, you know, so we still talk every once in a while. He moved out of state, but I felt really good about that, you know. It really put, that could have been me. But for the grace of God, there go I. Cirrhosis of the liver, not good. You know, I don't know how I never got, anyways, 10th step. I am not the best at. I just try not to do things that I know that I would have to make amends for. Sometimes I yell at my husband. You know, sometimes we have disagreements. Sometimes I have like fights with my best friend who used to live with me, and she's also an Alcoholics Anonymous. And we had to like sit back for a while and not talk to each other and talk to our sponsors for a little while before we could sit at the table and have a like adult conversation. And you know what? We're still friends. And that's like the thing with Alcoholics Anonymous. It repairs relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, she's still my best friend today. She doesn't live with me. She moved to Baltimore, but she's still my best friend. We had a huge fight. Oh my God, a huge fight. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous, we still get to be friends. We get to use the tools here to look at, like, okay, this is where I'm wrong, and that's where I'm going to leave it. I'm not going to look at your part. I know it's there, but this is my part, and I'm going to just keep my side of the street clean or at the best that I can. So 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation to blanking. Contact God as we understood him. So I've been doing that a lot lately. You guys might think this is weird and hokey, but I do yoga every single day. And so my meditation is like a moving meditation. I can't just sit and pray and then like listen. You know, I really have to be moving. And the thoughts kind of go away, and I'm able to give it a rest. Just give this a rest. You know what I mean? Yes, that my body is moving, but I don't have to think about now, later, tomorrow, yesterday. You know what I mean? Like, it's okay. This is where I am right now. Anyways, lost my train of thought. So I also do guided meditations on YouTube, or my sponsor told me about this app. It's called the Insight Timer app. It's a meditation. It's got tons of guided meditations. So, like, reading those 24 hours a day and the daily reflections and stuff like that, I have never been able to be consistent with. I don't know why. Maybe it's I got some ADD going on still, but I'll read words on a page and they won't sink in. But if I'm listening to it, it kind of sets me at ease, and that works for me. So I don't know. Give it a try. If you're having a hard time with the meditation thing, give it a try. It might work for you too. The 12th step, carry this message to another alcoholic and practice these principles in all of our affairs. I mean, I'm kind of doing that right now. I have sponsored people. This one woman that I was sponsoring for a couple of years, She would have a year and then drink again. And then this last time she had a little over 2 years and then she drank again. And then, we went back to step one again. And I gave her some suggestions. And she said she started to do it, but then she just texted me last week, I'm not avoiding you, but I don't feel like being sponsored right now. And I'm like, okay. I kind of figured that's okay. I'm here if you need me, when you want this help. And she said she was going to come today, but then she backed out again. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So, I have service positions at meetings. You know, it's not like just sponsoring people is a 12-step. Like, it's what do you do for Alcoholics Anonymous? So I'm speaking here. I have service tomorrow night at the Camel Group. I do cleanup. Sometimes I do cakes there. Also, I'm going to be asking people to speak there, just the five-minute speakers, not the guest speaker. But maybe like last year, I had the guest speaker seeker position, and that was at a time, I'll wrap this up in just a minute, that was at a time that in my sobriety I kind of fell into this place where I got this great job that was going to fix me, and then the great job fell through. And I was, like, in a really dark place. But I had this position. I had to get really good speakers for the Camel Group because we had get really good speakers. And, like, oh, my God. So I had to go and do homework. I went to all these meetings that I never went to before. I sought good speakers. And I came, I did my service, and it saved my life again. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life again. And it continues to every day. So I hope that covered everything. Thank you all for letting me share. And it's been a good day. I brought some guys with me from my home group. And we went to Pig and Steak before. We're going to go to the Moo Through after. Like, it's just a good hang, you know. And so that's it. Thanks all for letting me share.